there are things that arise in later life that have to do, I would say, with the conflict of cultures that arises when you're dealing with somebody who either is an immigrant from another country, another culture, or is the child of immigrants, or even in the case, for example, of someone who's comes from a family in the U.S. which is deeply conservative and religious and breaks with that and subscribes to a, you know, a more cosmopolitan, shall we say, progressive culture. These are things that arise in later life. These are conflicts with their own cultural background and with the people who matter most to them.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Robert Paul. Dr. Paul, who everyone knows as Bobby, is famous for having three careers. He's been the dean at Emory College of Arts and Sciences. He's the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Anthropology and Interdisciplinary Studies at Emory, and he's also a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Emory University Psychoanalytic Institute. He's also a prolific writer. Some of his writings are on the notes at the end of the podcast. He has served on multiple editorial boards, including the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, American Imago, Psychoanalysis Culture and Society, Ethos, the Society for Psychological Anthropology publication series. And what we will discuss today is how these three careers, these three hats, these three ways of thinking have worked in tandem for him. We learn, for example, that while some busy deans work out in the gym or go for a run starting at 5 a.m., what Bobby does is he sees his analytic patients early in the morning. And for him, that grounds him and settles him and deepens his ability to bring his analytic mindset to the challenging administrative work that he had the rest of the day. As an anthropologist, we will learn that he was able to bring his study of culture to how he listens analytically, and giving him a special ability to work with people from foreign cultures as they approach the analytic task. He describes his field work in Nepal and studying different religious ways of thinking. And again, he brings that experience into his work in the analytic dyad. But for me, the conversation reveals the power of planting seeds, of planting ideas and new experiences. He describes his mentor and how he introduced to him the opportunity to go forward in his life. He describes how he has brought his own mentorship of others and inspired them to go forward in their various careers and interests. He has built a bridge, a program between academics and psychoanalysis that's really quite unique and remarkable. He'll describe it for us. And he also gives us clinical examples where patients from other cultures get stuck in that tension, that rough edge, that interface between the culture they came from and the culture they're now in the States. And he describes how his cultural sensitivity and his analytic ear helps the patient facilitate new freedoms and new abilities to relate to people who are important to them. I hope you enjoy this as much as I have. Here's my conversation with Dr. Robert Pohl. Bobby, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you on board this program. Bobby, you have had three careers. And I might add, you've famously had three careers. You're well known for having three careers. You've been a dean at Emory College of Arts and Sciences, a very well-known and very well-respected college in a major American university in Atlanta, Georgia. You've been a professor of anthropology, and you've been a training and supervising analyst at the Emory University Psychoanalytic Institute. And it seems to me that the advantage you're having these three careers brings you and brings us today to learn from you is that we can see how each of these fields and ways of thinking interdigitate with each other to the advantage, I imagine, to all of them. For example, as a dean, as an academic leader, you live in a different culture than the analytic one. And yet you've managed to build bridges between the two, which is not an easy thing to do. And as an anthropologist, you study cultures and layers of cultures, which seems to me to bear a real similarity to the layering of our minds that analysts are used to observing in themselves and in our analysands, and that your anthropologic ear would lend itself to your analytic ear in appreciating layers of meaning. Though at the same time, it occurs to me that an advantage we have as analysts is that we listen to associations, again, our own and our analysands, to confirm or disconfirm our hypotheses, to make sure that we're going down the right path and that we're not developing hypotheses that are satisfying to us but not meaningful for the moment. And I don't know if, as an anthropologist studying cultures, you have, obviously not associations in the way that we understand it, but whether there are some clues and cues that you can take in your studies that support the development of different hypotheses and can lead you to sort of orient yourself in a particular direction like we might clinically. And then there's your work as a clinical analyst. And it strikes me again that your anthropologic ear would augment your analytic ear in the sense that while all analyses are unique, all families are unique, so everyone we work with is from a different culture than ourselves. And it's important to recognize that even if patients have similarities to our own cultures, that we shouldn't assume we know what their experience is. We have to approach it as if they're coming from someplace different. It's also the case that if they come from a dramatically different part of the world with a different ethnic group, a different religious mindset, a different cultural orientation, that presents unique challenges in understanding what are neurotic conflicts and what are cultural conflicts. And so the question is, what's the relationship between analytic listening and anthropologic listening? So we have a lot to cover, but let's start. Share with us what it was like being a dean and being a psychoanalyst and how they did or didn't work together.
Well, I became a dean somewhat reluctantly. I didn't really aim to have an administrative career, but it turned out in the course of my being a member of a department that I was chair a number of times and had the misfortune to demonstrate that I was actually fairly good at it, which meant that I kept getting other administrative assignments. And I cared deeply about the direction of Emory College at the time. This was in the year 2001, and could see that colleges were going in various different directions and wanted to maintain our academic integrity and high scholarly standards and so on, and felt very strongly about it and allowed myself to be persuaded to be a candidate, and I became a dean. I would say that having been in psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic training beginning in the 80s, and so already quite immersed in it by that time, it made it possible for me to deal with individuals and with conflicts between and among individuals in a way that I think allowed me to do so with relative equanimity and judgment that wasn't clouded as much as was the case with some other administrators I've known by biases, ambitions, emotions, anger, and so on, which I think helped make me, and I think I was quite popular with the faculty for that very reason. And I saw myself as dean of the faculty in a way as the champion and advocate for the faculty in the context of the administration, which meant I was not always on the same page as the administrators, but that was something I also felt, that my ability to read people and to say what was tactful and to phrase what I wanted to say tactfully certainly came in very handy. Being a dean is a 24/7 kind of thing. You sometimes are up at night thinking about problems that come up. And people used to ask me, well, and I maintained a psychoanalytic practice all through that time. I've always had a small analytic practice because I have a full-time job as a professor, even when I'm not a dean. And people would say, well, how do you do it? And I would say, well, I do it after hours. I would start at 5 and do analytic work for the next several hours. And I would say, you know, it was refreshing because when you're a dean, you are dealing with all kinds of long-term issues and major conflicts, and the phone is always ringing and the email is always popping up. When you're an analyst, you're alone with one person, and you just are focused totally on what is happening between you in the room. And if you have something interesting to say, you say it right then, and you come back tomorrow. It was so much the opposite of what being a dean was like that I used to say that some people do yoga, some people meditate, some people run marathons. I analyze.
That was the same image that came to my mind. I picture some people go for a run at 5 a.m. To ground themselves, and you enter an analytic space. The other thing that strikes me in hearing you describe the skills you brought to your deanship work as an analyst is, you know, the theme of this podcast series, though we have varied with life circumstances changing, is psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Right. And I don't think I've ever heard a better description of how being analyzed and having analytic training skills avail somebody of working in other venues to the advantage of both, where you really bring what it means to be an analyst, and in your case, it's to the academic world, and it's a wonderful description of it. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And you built bridges with the different cultures. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, I did that at Dean and also in other capacities. I've been, as I said, chair of departments in the college, as well as being a director of the Institute. And one of the things I'm proudest of is having developed a psychoanalytic studies program at Emory, which is, I think, one of the best in the country and maybe one of the best in the world. And a very active group of scholars. It's a scholarly program rather than a clinical program that involves graduate students and faculty who utilize psychoanalytic ideas in their work. And in the mid-90s, I, along with some other faculty members and graduate students, basically built this bridge, what the road that divides the or used to divide the medical school from the college was called Clifton Road. So I always used to talk about building a bridge across Clifton. And we just yesterday actually had a meeting, or the day before yesterday on Friday, had a meeting of the executive committee of the psychoanalytic studies program to build a whole faculty of psychoanalysis, that is to include both the analytic institute, the psychoanalytic studies program, which has faculty in every school. We have people in theology, in nursing, in law, in business, as well as in the college. So we have a university-wide faculty of psychoanalysis, which is, I think, quite unique in the country and probably in the world. And of course, being in an administrative position certainly enabled me to make things like that happen.
Another advantage to having a psychoanalyst as a dean at Emory. Tell us about your work in anthropology and how you see that as interfacing with your work as an analyst.
Well, I did my anthropological field work beginning back in the 60s, believe it or not, in Nepal. I was interested in South Asian religions and ritual and symbolism and myth. And it turned out that at that time, a lot of people had studied Southern Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, the Buddhism of Sri Lanka and Thailand, Burma, Southeast, and Laos and Cambodia. But little was known at that time about Northern Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. And so I wanted to study people who were Tibetan related. Like, you couldn't go to Tibet in those days. So I studied people on this side of the border in Nepal who were practiced Tibetan culture or a form of Tibetan culture. And I was interested then in myth, symbolism, the religious system. I wrote a dissertation called Sherpas and Their Religion. The people I studied were the Sherpas, who are famous in the West for being somebody once referred to as the schleppers, the ones who carry up, you know,
the guides.
But they also have become mountaineers themselves. But that's not what I was, I mean, I was interested in that, but I was mainly interested in studying their religious system, which I did. And I wrote a thesis called Sherpas and Their Religion. And then later a book called The Tibetan Symbolic World, in which I gave psychoanalytic interpretations of the rich Tibetan symbolic world, which they elaborate in texts and in dances and in rituals, and which they paint in fantastic murals on their walls of their temples, and gave it produced a whole body of symbolic work that I was able to apply psychoanalytic principles to. It was also the case that, like many in the 60s who when I went to Nepal, people basically said, "Where's that?" When I came back, everyone was like, "Oh man, who's your guru?" I did a dynamite hat over there, and so a sea change had occurred. But in any event, you know, I was very moved by the power of Buddhist monasticism, and not monasticism as such, but the discipline of Buddhist practice. And I didn't want to become a Buddhist. A lot of people I knew did become Buddhists. But I, one of the things that came from that was that I saw psychoanalysis as the closest Western equivalent of the kind of self-disciplined introspection and investigation of self, along with a guru, in this case, an analyst. And that was one of my main motivations for pursuing later when I could, for pursuing analytic training.
Have you concluded, having traversed this path of analytic training and analytic work, and reflecting back on the fantasy you had when you began it, what do you think about the similarities and or differences between the Buddhist method and the analytic method?
Well, that's a very good question, and I've thought a lot about that. I think there are tremendous overlaps, and that the notion of overcoming attachment and the ego, which are sometimes, or, you know, and recognizing the non-existence of self, which are central ideas in Buddhism, have a great deal to do with overcoming one's narcissism and one's defenses on the one hand, and on the other hand, accepting the fact that a part of the mix of being human includes the three Buddhist central sins of lust, anger, and ignorance, that there's a real overlap there with what we deal with all the time as analysts, and what we deal with in ourselves, since once one is analyzed on the couch, speaking of being off the couch, you continue, of course, when mm-hmm. you're on the couch to reflect analytically on what you're sure. doing. That's a lifelong project. So I would say, I find, and you know, I was one of the original founders of the symposium that has met regularly at APSA, at the APSA meetings on Buddhism and psychoanalysis. And now that's become a whole big field. There are many of people yes. who do that and incorporate Buddhist ideas. I also, you know, was a meditator for a while. I don't so much do it anymore. I regret somehow not being disciplined at the moment about it. But I do think, you know, it's not an adjunct. It's not the same as analysis, but it's a good adjunct to it. When people say to me, you know, does meditation serve as a substitute for analysis? The answer is clearly no. That's the same as asking whether going to the gym and working out is a cure for whatever mm-hmm. you have. But they do augment each other.
Just to dip a toe a little deeper into this, it has seemed to me that an important difference is that the relationship with the analyst is significantly apart from my understanding of the relationship with the guru on a number of bases, one of which is that whatever passions and fantasies and imaginations are hidden in us, the analyst is available to help us get to know them in vivo, in real time, in the moment with the analyst, for the purpose of getting perspective on it and then deciding what you want to do with it, which could include leaving it in the past. Is that not fundamentally different than the relationship with the guru?
Yes, it certainly is. I don't want to claim that these are exactly parallel. There are obviously huge differences as well as the similarities I mentioned. But the idea of in the moment recognizing and naming the manifestations of these kinds of wishes, drives, defenses against them, mm-hmm. and so on, that is not something that a guru does, though confronting, for example, something like anger or egotism is something they do, though the prescription for it is different, which is to meditate on the opposite.
Meditate
on compassion, which is a, you know, something that there is a very successful program that colleagues of mine at Emory have helped develop. On compassion meditation, but it's not the same.
Yeah,
it's a distinctively Western idea, I think, to really engage in that kind of reflectiveness on what's going on with oneself at the moment in the way that analysis allows, that I don't think is present in mm-hmm. Many Western and non-Western traditions.
So speaking of Western, so you're an anthropologist and an analyst, and you have both ears always operating. What has being an anthropologist added to your clinical listening when you're working with someone who not only is different than you, which everyone is, but is culturally dramatically different than you?
Well, I've had the good fortune to have a number of analysands and people in therapy who came from another culture. I always was on the lookout for such people and was grateful to have such people turn up in my practice. I do feel that in most cases, being an anthropologist and knowing something, in some cases, Asian cultures in particular, ones that I knew a good deal about, and in others, ones where I could certainly make the leap to understand what those cultures were like, to hear about the embeddedness of the analytic work in a much broader cultural, sociological surround that I always bring to my thinking, along with a very personal and individualized attention.
The classic moment is when the analyst sees something as a neurotic conflict and the analysand sees it as a cultural conflict.
Yeah.
Though I've encountered it going the other way as well, where the analyst, having been taught how to listen for cultural proclivities, attributes it to the culture, and the analysand will say, no, it's not that. This time it's not that. This is my, you know, inhibition working now. What's it been like for you?
Well, there are things that arise in later life that have to do, I would say, with the conflict of cultures that arises when you're dealing with somebody who either is an immigrant from another country, another culture, or is the child of immigrants, or even in the case, for example, of someone who's comes from a U.S., a family in the U.S., which is deeply conservative and religious, yeah, and breaks with that and subscribes to a more cosmopolitan, shall we say, progressive culture, that these are things that arise in later life. These are conflicts with their own cultural background and with the people who matter most to them. That is, most of these non-Western cultures place a much greater emphasis on the importance of embeddedness within the family, embeddedness within the culture, relatedness, relational aspects of life, which in America and in analysis we're only kind of coming to see the importance of, that it's there whether you think it is or not. But there certainly is in the Western world a vastly greater emphasis on individual autonomy, yeah, on separating from the parents, separating from the cultural norms, becoming a sort of self-made and more critically and reflexively aware person than is acceptable in the other cultures. Where I've run into this most dramatically has been in either immigrants or immigrant children of immigrants, in the broad sense that I just gave, who, because they have made a choice in their sexual lives or in their relationship lives, are unacceptable from the point of view of their culture and of their family, their immediate family and their extended family, face intensely painful problems within themselves, conflicts within themselves that involve loyalty to their culture and to their parents and to their family, and at the same time commitment to their project as an American to do what successful Americans do and do it in analysis. This is not something that arises from early childhood conflicts, though it can certainly be colored by them. There's no question that it can tie into them. But it's a cultural problem, and it's a really genuinely painful conflictual problem that I see have seen over and over again. Just by coincidence, I don't know if you've seen the Times this morning, but in the book review section, there's a book by an anthropologist named Joe Henrich, who's a friend and colleague of mine, on the weirdest people in the world. Weird meaning Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. That we are different from everybody else in the extent to which we're not embedded in kinship structures and in family structures. And so that we see, for example, enmeshment when other people see, well, I'm just doing what a good child in this culture is supposed to do. And so those kinds of differences are real. If I could give one example.
Sure.
I had in treatment once a woman who had left her culture behind, a very traditional, what we would view as culturally conservative part of the world, and had come to this country and been very successful in breaking with all of that not breaking with her family. I mean, she maintained relations with them, though they, you know, they understood each other's differences, or they allowed for each other's differences. But she had made herself into a successful professional person in this country, and subscribed to a kind of a liberal, progressive worldview that prevails in, the urban, industrialized, metropolitan era of culture of the West. And we dealt with all kinds of issues. She brought up various kinds of things that she experienced as problems. And I felt we weren't getting anywhere until we hit on the fact that she was afraid to tell me and afraid to admit to herself that she was afraid that one of her children was gay, and that she knew she was supposed to be okay with that, but that on the basis of her upbringing, she really just absolutely couldn't tolerate the thought and was horrified by it and couldn't imagine how she could deal with this particular child of hers. And once we got to that problem, the therapeutic work changed, and we dealt with that on the level at which it was a cultural problem. And there was tremendous advantage to that. I mean, I think that she left the treatment feeling reconciled with that child and able to deal with it and reconciled within herself. But this was not a conflict that had arisen in childhood. This was a conflict that arose out of her adult experience and of being caught between two cultures.
You know, it reverberates with experiences I've seen in the office lately, where there is such a current intense zeitgeist of what is permitted to think and say and what is not permitted to think and say, that numbers of patients, by no means all, but numbers of patients are frightened of saying things that don't fit in with the current liberal culture, let's call it that for a shorthand. And they are really worried that I will be an enforcer of the culture and join with their imaginings and the realities of people who say you cannot say certain things.
What?
And they take it to mean you cannot think certain things.
Exactly.
And that sounds like it was an issue with your patient as well. It would seem to me that the pivot point is not simply how you choose to live your life behaviorally, but the freedom we would welcome in being able to think whatever you want.
Right.
And that's how we can be of help, because you would live your life, I think, more gracefully if you had freedom to think about anything.
Exactly. And the fact that you think it doesn't mean you have to either say it or
sure.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that Freud realized, and I think was one of his greatest insights, which is just thinking. Many people feel that to even think something implies a transgression on their part when they haven't actually done or said anything bad.
Right, right. Bobby, how do you find yourself where you are, having done all these things, and they relate to each other, and yet they're separate from each other? They're different career paths. When you look back on where you are at this age, and visit your history, how do you make sense of it?
Well, that's a big question.
I understand. We got a few minutes.
I'd read some of Freud even as a high schooler. I'd read selections from The Interpretation of Dreams and found it fascinating. But I never did anything with it academically, either in college not in college. When I went to graduate school in anthropology at the University of Chicago, I had the good fortune to have as my main mentor, Mel Spiro, who was very psychoanalytic in his approach and intrigued me with his interest in that area. He went on to do analytic training at the San Diego Institute. He moved from Chicago to San Diego to found the anthropology department there. So he influenced me a great deal. And when I went to the field, one of my aims was to study how different people chose different paths, religious paths, from a psychoanalytic point of view, looking at their life history. What led someone to take monastic vows? someone else to become a married lay practitioner, which they have there, somebody else to become a shaman, somebody else to do nothing at all. So I went with a kind of a psychological problem in mind, in addition to looking at the religion itself. And I wrote a number of articles in which I used psychoanalytic ideas to apply to Sherpa and Tibetan culture. And my book, The Tibetan Symbolic World, is very psychoanalytic. But I also realized at a certain point that there was only so much I could do with it, that I didn't really know enough about psychoanalysis. And I was aware that I needed to go further, but I wasn't sure how to do that. Well, I happened to have a conversation with Ralph Rauten, who was then director of our institute and, of course, a very distinguished analyst. I told him that he said, we're accepting a new class in our analytic institute. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I've always been interested, but I'm not an MD, so of course I can't do that. He said, oh, no, there's such a thing as a waiver. You can certainly do that. And before I knew it, I had what was then called a course waiver. And I was enrolled in the institute as a clinical candidate. I immersed myself in analytic training. That occurred when I was in my mid-late 40s, when people traditionally have midlife crises. And I was really delighted to have a new turn in my intellectual world. Analytic work and learning about analytic technique and hearing from the couch, all kinds of things that both were the same and different from what you hear as an anthropologist. I found this immensely absorbing. Mel Spiro had said to me, you know, you've done a lot of interesting things in your life, but this is going to be the most interesting of all of them. Mm. And my first supervisor, Larry Inderbitson, told me the same thing. And they were both right. How I became a dean, as I said at the beginning, really had more to do with my commitment to the academic life and the academic world and to my commitment to Emory College. I had no, like when I stopped being a dean, most people after they become deans then want to become provosts and presidents. I had no interest in that. I just wanted to see Emory do the right thing. And I feel that in my decade as dean of Emory, I started a lot of interesting programs, hired a fantastic number of really great people from very diverse cultural backgrounds, I must say, and racial backgrounds, and feel I was able to just make a commitment to the academy as a way of life. And I feel the same about the institute, that I feel that the analytic institutes also are institutes. Of course, being an anthropologist gives you some insight to how institutes work and how they're organized and what they need and what you need to do. I find that most academics don't have any realistic sense of what it takes to run a university, and most analysts don't have much of a sense of what it takes to run an institute either. But, you know, we're forced to do that. But I took it as a kind of an avocation and was very glad to have spent those years doing that. And frankly, I'm very glad not to be doing it anymore, because I really feel tremendous compassion and empathy for the guy who is now dean of Emory College, Michael Elliott, who's doing a fantastic job and who I plucked, if I may say so, from the faculty to be a senior associate dean and then went on to become the dean. I recognized him as a real potential leader, but I certainly wouldn't like to be in his shoes right now.
Bobby, people often ask analysts about the impact we have on the world. You know, the relatively small numbers of people we work with over a long time on an intimate basis. And of course, the people we treat when it goes well are so profoundly different that we're not only affecting them, but their whole world and their children and their colleagues and their families. But also as we learn through this podcast and many other IPA efforts, analysts work off the couch as well, you being a perfect example of it, bringing their skills to these other areas. But In listening to you, this conversation, and there's a theme that runs through it to my ear, and that is you had a mentor, you mentioned Mel Spiro, and so many of us have had mentors. And so many people I've spoken with have described the influence of mentors. And it's planting a seed. One little seed gets planted and it blossoms in so many directions. I mean, your work as dean and starting the bridge that you've built and this whole program in the university. I mean, all the lives that have been affected by that. You're one patient. You're one that you mentioned, the woman who struggled over having thoughts that she thought she shouldn't have. And she left with more freedom and ease to have these thoughts. And as you said, was reconciled with her child. I mean, these are major impacts on the world that just little seeds that we offer grow into. And you, by virtue of having all these careers, have planted many seeds. And I have no doubt that there are large numbers, not only of patients, but of students and faculty that have been influenced by your creativity and your generosity. And you use the word compassion. And I want to thank you for that for them. But more importantly, thank you for agreeing to join me on this conversation so I could get to know you and your work better, and our listeners can as well. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I hope this podcast and your whole podcast series, obviously, follows the same precept that you just laid down of planting seeds, and who knows where they land, but many of them come to fruition and continue to you know, people hear this and maybe it has an impact on their lives. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.